So last class, we started looking at how to describe the kinds of things that physically occur in the lab. So any preparation procedure for a quantum system can be represented by a density operator rho. And a density operator is a non-negative operator with unit trace. So now let's turn our attention to describing realistic measurements. Okay, so we'll look at two scenarios. So the first scenario is one where we have a mixture of measurements. So we consider just a simple scenario to illustrate this. So consider a PVM. PVM stands for projector valued measure, which in this case, the word measure is overkill because it's going to be discrete. We'll call it PI, with I going from 1 to D. Okay, so these are projectors, so they satisfy so it's an orthogonal projective measurement, and then a second PVM. Which we'll use the other projector notation, pi L, with L going from 1 to D. And again, these are mutually orthogonal. And self-adjoint. Okay, so now the actual measurement procedure, which can be a result of noise or intentional act, the actual measurement procedure is to apply the projective measurement denoted by P with probability P. And the other projective measurement with probability 1 minus p. So now the point is, while the elements of the first projective measurements are mutually orthogonal and the elements of the second are mutually orthogonal, it's not the case. In general, pl pi k, put it this way, are not orthogonal. In general, okay, so given preparation rho, the probability of some outcome nu, how do I do this? We can write it as the trace of E nu rho, where we've defined E nu is equal to P he knew for new going from 1 to D. And E nu is equal to 1 minus P pi nu. How do I want to do this? E nu pi nu minus D for nu going from D plus 1 to 2D. Okay, so we've introduced these operators E nu. We've defined them. We have this scale factor P, which is in general between 0 and 1, for the first D elements. And then the next D elements have scale factor 1 minus P and are associated with the other projector. Okay, so so this way we get a Born-type rule for describing our measurement probabilities in terms of these more abstract measurement operators. Okay, so the set E nu satisfies each element is non-negative. I should call it A. B, the sum over all nu E nu is equal to identity, which you can verify. So when we consider mixtures of measurements in general, we find a set of this form where this set can be arbitrarily large. I have an arbitrarily large number of elements. Okay, any questions about that? So now the more interesting scenario is scenario 2. Scenario 2, we're going to see how do we model a measurement where I have a state describing my system, and then I'm going to do a projective measurement on a composite Hilbert space. So the system of interest plus some other system. And then now I want to describe the effective measurement operators I get when I trace out the Ancilla system. Okay, so we have H is equal to HA tensor HB. We have rho is some preparation for system A. Let me do this. We'll have rho B be some preparation for system B. And then we have a PVM P sub L. We call it P sub nu for now. Which are linear operators on, well, each element of which, where P nu is an element of the linear operators on HA tensor HB. Okay, so the way we can think about this is we have system B up here, system A down here, and then we're applying some joint measurement to both systems. And so here, nu is going to be running from 1 up to, what should I call it? Let me call it D, where D is going to be less than or equal to the dimension of HA times the dimension of HB. Okay, so if this was a perfectly distinguishing measurement for all outcomes, D would be equal to this dimension. But we can, of course, have high-rank projectors in this set. Okay, so then according to Born's rule, the probability of outcome nu is equal to the trace of rho A tensor rho b, which is our joint state, rho a b, against this projector. But now the point is we want an effective description on system A alone. Using operators on system A alone. Okay, so we're going to take the partial trace and trace out the other degrees of freedom. Okay, so let's write out the explicit expression. We're going to sum over I and J from 1 to M, sum over K and L from 1 to N. Over here we're letting M equal the dimension of HA and N equal the dimension of HB. And then we take the matrix elements of P, so we have I, K, J, L, and the matrix elements of rho A, the matrix elements of rho B. So for example, what this means, P nu I, K, J, L, is just the matrix element I tensor K P nu J tensor L. And likewise for these guys. And then we realize we can write this as probability of outcome nu is equal to the trace of E nu rho A, where we've defined the matrix elements of E nu as summing over the other indices E nu ij kl, sorry, ik jl, multiplied by the components of the ancilla state. So the ancilla system state now plays a role in determining our probabilities of finding a particular outcome. Yeah. Oh, an ancilla, what's the right way to define it? So typically it means anything that's not the system. So it's when you have some system of interest, like for example, an electron spin. And how many of you do not know what a Stern-Gerlach measurement is? Okay, the Stern-Gerlach, good. So the Stern-Gerlach measurement is you have an electron or any particle with a spin, say, proceeding spatially in this direction, you send it through a magnetic field gradient, it receives a momentum kick, either up or down, depending on the spin along that axis. So now what you want to do is you want to measure the spin degree of freedom. So you want something where, if, you know, Alice is shooting particles at you, and she's either going to give it spin up or spin down or any spin she wants, you want to be able to test what spin she gave it. So what you're interested in is the spin. But the way you measure the spin is that you look at this, you capture the particle spatially. And if you find the particle spatially up, then you infer that the spin was up and vice versa for down. In that case, you would say that the position degree of freedom of the electron is the ancilla. You're using it as a means to an end to access information about the system of interest, which is just the spin degree of freedom. So in this case, that's not what we're doing. In this case, the measurement operator P is a measurement on both the spin and spatial degrees of freedom in that an example. So I'll give you another example of von Neumann's indirect measurement model, which is more along the lines of what I was just talking about. So the ancilla is just some other degree of freedom, which has a Hilbert space, which you're not directly interested in that system, except to the extent that it gives you information about. So this is with indices, it's a little bit hard to see what's going on, so we can just identify E nu as the partial trace over system B of P nu times identity on system A. So the point is the measurement operators we've obtained, which give us, again, the Born rule, which is, I mean, I'll explain later, but this is basically an inner product. The operators we obtain include information about the type of projective measurement you did in the system and the initial state of the ancilla. It helps determine the statistics you're going to get because your measurement is looking at correlations. So the correlations will depend on the state of the ancilla. Something funny about that statement. There's no correlations here. Okay, let me rethink that statement. That's a little bit misleading. Was there a question? And so we remark again that when we create these abstract measurement operators, they satisfy the same two properties. So they're non-negative, and if we sum over all outcomes, we get the identity operator. And let me just emphasize here that this measurement operator is a linear operator on system A alone. So we've achieved the goal of describing effectively, having a way to predict our statistics, which is all we can compare the quantum formalism to, or the statistics we observe in the lab. We have now a way of predicting the correct quantum statistics using only operators defined on our system Hilbert space. Okay. Yes.
Projection operator has been derived using a product state between system A and system B. Mm-hmm. How do one go about it that it's an entangled state between A and B such that you can't decompose them into a...
Yeah, that's a very good question. So it turns out that that's something that people ignore. So this is one of the reasons why I started this section by saying, look, a lot of people in the community, in fact, I would say the majority of people in the community, elevate, so let me just define, so this object, okay, so this set, any set of operators E nu satisfying A and B is called a POVM. Which is a nice way to say it. The hard way to say it is to actually spell it out, which is positive operator valued measure. Okay, so obviously people don't say that. So POVM is what you always hear. Positive operator, because they're positive operators. And it's a probability measure, but an operator-valued probability measure. So the fact that this is a property that you expect a measure to satisfy, summing over the elements gives you 1, or the identity operator in this case, because it's operator valued. The term measure is overkill here because it's just a discrete set, so probability distribution. So really, it's a positive operator valued probability distribution. We use the word measure to include the case when nu is a continuous index. So for example, when measuring onto the SU2 coherent states or something, then you have a continuous set of measurement operators. And then you need a notion of probability that extends to continuous sets, and that's where you need measure theory. So it's a heavy-handed terminology for this special case. Now, to come back to your question, what people do is they elevate the notion of POVM as a postulate of quantum mechanics. And so what they're trying to do there is, this is my opinion, it's similar to taking the friction term to describe a dissipative system and elevating that to the level of a fundamental postulate. So if I'm doing all kinds of like fancy theory and trying to understand where classical mechanics comes from a deeper theoretical underpinning, you know, there's one thing, you can try and derive Hamilton's equations of motions from some set of simple principles like Galilean invariance and other things like that. And you say, oh, well, I can't do it because I can't get the friction term. Or someone say, well, why don't you directly try and derive the Lagrange equations of motions with the friction term included? You're like, well, actually, if I derive the ideal Lagrange equations for an arbitrary number of degrees of freedom, then I always get the friction term as a byproduct of just ignoring the 10 to the 23 degrees of freedom that are creating the friction when I ignore them, right? That lead to violations of energy and momentum. So rather than look for a physical principle which includes violation of energy and momentum, I'm going to look to a physical principle which preserves conservation of energy and momentum, and just take into account that friction term comes up as an effective phenomenon from ignoring some degrees of freedom. I think that's the right way to think about this. But unfortunately, there's, you know, dozens of papers written in the last 10 years of people trying to find physical principles that imply the postulates of quantum mechanics, and one of the postulates they try and derive directly is this kind of postulate. The measurement operators aren't projectors, but they're positive operators. And I think that's, first of all, conceptually the wrong way to approach it, and second of all, in practice, it's the wrong way to approach it because there are measurements you can do which are not POVMs. And in particular, it's when the system and ancilla are entangled, then the effective measurement operator you get is not a positive operator. In fact, the Born rule doesn't even hold anymore because you don't get a linear functional anymore. You get a more general structure, which can include nonlinearities. So, yeah, so that's the reason. Even though I express it as an operational postulate, it is, in fact, not the most general thing that can happen. It's the most general thing that can happen under the assumption that, wherever I wrote it, under the assumption that, where did I write it? Over there? Oh, yeah, under the assumption that the preparation is a product preparation. And in fact, the same thing happens, in fact, this example is even more explicit in the case of transformations. So when we look at transformations, we're gonna describe them by these completely positive maps and Krauss operators. And it turns out that model is only valid if the input state to the transformation is a factorable state of this form. And so people elevate the notion of a CP map as something that is a postulate of quantum mechanics, but it's not true. And in fact, when people do experiments, like I was involved in an experiment at MIT 10 years ago where we did process tomography on a transformation to determine what transformation we did on some nuclear spins. And the map we measured was not a completely positive map. And that was because it turns out our system had correlations between certain degrees of freedom that violated that assumption. All right. Okay, so this is the key point here. We've identified as a provisional or practical postulate from these two scenarios that we can describe measurement operators in terms of a POVM, which satisfies these properties, and that seems to capture all the scenarios we can think of, again, under the assumption that the input state is uncorrelated. So now we can elevate this Let's elevate this to a working postulate. I'm sure I did somewhere. Oh, right. Well, I guess before we get to that, let's talk about some other things. All right, let's talk about indirect measurement a bit, because this is going to be an important model for understanding a wide variety of things. One, how do you actually do measurements? Two, when can we apply the Luters rule? Okay, the Luters state update rule applies in some limited scenario, and we can understand the limitations of that scenario through this model. It also ties into questions of quantum foundations. So my understanding is that you have a problem that's a little bit more subtle than this on the homework, so maybe this will help you understand what's going on there. But basically the idea is, I should probably follow my notes, so I use the same notation. Here, we'll use this kind of quantum computing notation where we imagine we associate each system with a line, which you can think of as a wire. And then and what we're going to do is we're going to apply a unitary that takes as input both of these systems. And then we're going to apply a measurement onto the ancilla system. So this is the ancilla, and this is the system. And then we're going to have some output state. I'm just going to freestyle this. Okay, so have questions? No? Okay. So von Neumann, the reason why von Neumann developed this model was to actually address the question of measurement, because he wanted to understand how can we think about the state after measurement. And so he actually considered you had two particles coming in and scattering off of each other, and you knew the momenta of the initial particles. And then you measured the momentum of one of the output particles, and then you wanted to use the principle of conservation of energy and momentum to predict the momentum of the remaining particle. So von Neumann said, look, I have two particles coming in. They scatter off of each other. I have some input vector k, p, some output vector k prime, and I want to ask what's the final momentum. So classically, we can deduce this quantum mechanically. We assume conservation of energy and momentum still holds, so we should be able to deduce the momentum of this particle. So what he said is, look, let's interpret this as a measurement. Or let's consider this as a model of measurement, where this interaction then is the unitary, which couples the two systems. And then here I'm measuring the output momentum of this particle. And then I want to assign a state to describe the output of this system. And he says, we can deduce what the state is, so therefore I can deduce what the update rule is. Let's look at this more abstractly. So the system has Hilbert space HA. We're going to measure some observable on the system. Let's just make it easy on ourselves and make it a rank one projectors. set of rank one projectors that span the space. And then we imagine that the input state row is, we're just going to write it as psi, where psi is going to be some linear combination. We're going to write psi out in terms of the eigenstates of A. So here psi is in a coherent superposition of these eigenstates. Now for system B, let's just assume that the input state, suppose we can think now about this piece we can think about that there's a lot of tapping we can think about that as the measurement apparatus. Okay, so everything inside that dotted line is the measurement apparatus. And you can think about the ancilla, you can think about this as the pointer position. Okay, so this is analogous to when I would draw a box like this. So we have a dial which chooses the measurement, and then we had a readout which has a pointer on it and gives us an outcome. And then a system comes in and a system comes out. So the system coming in is system A. So this is row A, this is row A prime. Okay, so now row A is this pure state. And so we assume that the initial state of the apparatus is in some fixed ready state. And for ease of analysis, we'll just assume it's some pure state. So we'll let rho be equal just 0, 0. So now the point is, what we want to learn about are, you know, which of these eigenvalues of A is appropriate. So if the system is in a pure state that's an eigenstate of A, then if it's in state 3, I should always get outcome 3. Okay, so there's a faithful measurement condition. So how do we design an interaction that correctly identifies distinguishes the orthonormal input states L, where each L is an element of HA. So if I put in spin down, I want my apparatus to always have the pointer telling me it was spin down. And if I put in spin up, the apparatus always has to tell me it was spin up. If I put in a coherent superposition of spin up and spin down, the apparatus should give me spin up or spin down with the correct probability, which is the magnitude of this coefficient squared. So how do we do that? Well, we want some unitary that takes as input L tensor 0. And produce, so we demand, and this is how we design the apparatus, we demand that the apparatus implements a unitary which, when acting on L tensor 0, produces L tensor L, where this is A and this is B. Okay, so then by linearity, U acting on a superposition is going to produce sum over L CL L tensor L. Where again, my A's are on the left, my B's are on the right of the tensor product symbol. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so now we have the following situation. Now we have so here we have row A, row B, and at this stage, we have some, let's call it sigma of AB. So this is a density operator. For A and B at this moment in time. So sigma AB is equal to, let's call it phi phi, where phi is equal to a sum over L CL L tensor L. So now what I can do is I can define this piece here. I can define this measurement here with some measurement B, which is going to be a sum over, let's say, K, BKK. So here for simplicity, let's assume here that we assume that the dimension of HA is equal to the dimension of HB. Because we don't need that to be true, but it just complicates the description. Okay, so we're summing over a basis of system B. So now what we know is that now the pointer on system B, the pointer of the measurement function for B gives a random outcome. Let's call it K naught. Where the probability of outcome K naught is obtained from the Born rule. It's equal to sigma AB identity on system A tensor my projector K. Is my cursive legible? This is a projector onto K. And of course, remember, sigma AB is equal to U rho A tensor rho B U dagger. So this gives us the probability of that. And now we know that the probability of K naught, if we evaluate this expression, we're going to get the probability of K naught is going to be equal to CK squared. Okay, we had these amplitudes of each different eigenstate L of the system. So this is spin up, spin down. So think of this L, think of this as, you know, L equals 0 is spin up. L equals 1 is spin down. Half, plus half, minus half. These are just labels, so it doesn't matter what we call it. And you can think of the elements K as being, you know, you can think of K equals 0 is pointer to the right. And K equals 1 is pointer to the left. So the point is what we've done is we've correlated the final pointer position with the input state. Spin up or spin down. And not only did we correlate it, but we also correlated the probabilities. So the probability of getting the pointer to the right is exactly the probability that the input spin had spin up. And the probability of getting the pointer to the left is exactly the probability that the initial state had spin down. And now this is called indirect measurement. Because, you know, the violence of measurement is only applied to the ancilla. I shouldn't say violence, the disruption of measurement is only applied to system B. Right? So there's all this confusion about, well, when is my measurement represented by the update rule, and when, like when I absorb a photon, I completely destroy it. Well, look, I don't have to worry about that because the measurement is being applied to system B. System A, you know, once I decide to measure operator B, these things can be space-like separated, so it's not going to affect what's happening over here. So the state here at this point in time prior to the measurement, and the state here at this point in time, which is after the measurement, it's not going to change by locality. All right, there was a question? Yeah, it's just a knot, K0. That's the outcome you get. K0 is either 0 or 1. I see. Let me call it K prime. And let's call this K prime and this K prime. Thank you. That's better. Am I missing any other? Oh, here too, it should be K prime. K prime, K prime, K prime. I just want to distinguish K prime as the actual outcome you get from K, which is a variable over the possibilities. Yeah?
I'm having some trouble seeing how you went from problems of K prime as a trace to the CBA squared. Yeah.
Okay, good. Let's work that through. It's a good exercise. Okay, so we're going to take this expression, where this is the definition of sigma AB, which actually we have an explicit form over there. We're going to try to see how we get this result. So we want the probability of K prime is equal to the trace of, what did I call sigma, phi phi over there? Phi phi. Identity on A, tensor K prime on system B. Phi is equal to a sum over L, CL, L tensor L. So now, okay, there's two ways to do this. One is you just take this ket and you just bring it over here. That's a quasi-legal move. I mean, I think it is. It's legal, but it's hard to justify directly. The way to see it, the way to justify it is just you insert a complete set of states to evaluate the trace. So remember, the trace of anything is just a sum over alpha, alpha dot alpha, where alpha is an orthonormal basis for the space. We choose the first component to be equal to phi, and every other component, alpha not equal to 0, to be orthogonal to phi. All right, and then we can just simply, we realize that what this reduces to then is exactly phi identity A tensor K prime phi. And now we insert the definition of phi. So we're going to get L L prime C L bar L L tensor L identity tensor K prime K prime. Where here it's worth remembering that this is on B and this is on A. And then we insert the second sum. Which involves L prime, tensor L prime. Okay, and now everything that's on the left of the tensor product goes together, and everything that's on the right of the tensor product goes together. So we have sum over L L prime, C L square. I can't do that yet. C L bar C L prime. L is going to hit the identity, and then it's going to hit L prime. So we're going to get L, L prime. And then on the right of the tensor, we get this bra term as a linear functional that acts on a vector in the second Hilbert space. What vector is it? It's this vector here. So we're going to get L K prime, and these are just regular multiplication of scalars. And then over here, we had this L prime already carried all the way through. And then this L prime hits K prime, because now K prime is a linear functional on system B, so it's acting on the vector in system B. So we get K prime L prime. So this tells us that L is equal to L prime, L is equal to K prime, and K prime is equal to L prime. So basically everything, only one term survives, and it's the term where L equals L prime, which equals K prime. So we get CK prime squared as expected. Yes?
Are you assuming there's no degenerate subspace? Like this K prime is only one dimension?
Yeah, it probably gets more interesting when you have degenerate subspaces. And in fact, it becomes non-trivial. And yeah, so we'll get to that actually, because that's important. Yeah. Oh, there was no question? Okay. Yeah, so now we've recovered the simplest form of the update rule, which is von Neumann's original version, but we haven't recovered that yet. So now we get this. So we get K prime with this probability, but now when we actually do, so if we do an ensemble of repetitions of this experiment where we, you know, press the go button, the system moves forward, I get an outcome, I repeat many, many times, I collect the outcomes, the probability of each K prime is given by this coefficient squared. So now that's how I've measured the input state. But now the next question is, what's the state after the measurement? And so, okay, what's the right way to see this? I guess there's two ways to do it. So this is where von Neumann appealed to conservation of energy and momentum, saying that once I get the outcome for the momentum of the upper particle, there's no other possibility if energy and momentum are conserved, except that I know what the momentum of the second particle was. So here what we can do is just appeal to, so that's an empirical fact, I guess. We can appeal to the idea of a repeatable measurement. Okay, so I have some unit. I forget the dashed lines. I have some unit, which is my measurement device. Remember, it takes as input system A, and it produces as output system A, now described by a different operator. And I have some pointer, and the pointer picks to some value of k. K equals 0, k equals 1. Well, it doesn't have to be, it's just any value of k. Let me just leave it open. So this is my readout. K prime. And of course, I have a dial on here which chooses which operator I'm measuring, which is A. Okay, this chooses the operator A. And now, what I want to say is that this device works well. So this device is repeatable. So what that means is that If I repeat this procedure with, this is the same device, same setting. Okay, so the setting is the knob here. And of course, here the pointer starts out in some ready position, and then it moves to the answer. Here the device will start out in some ready position. Remember, there's a light here that goes off, tells us we got an answer. And now we're going to get row A double prime. So now what you want is a device that's capable of doing a repeatable measurement. Okay? So if the device doesn't do a repeatable measurement, it means I get outcome k equals 0, and then I measure the system again, and I get a different outcome. So that's going to happen if either my device is poorly designed, or if the settings are different, I'm measuring non-commuting observables. If I'm measuring the same observable twice in a row, I should get the same outcome. Quantum mechanics allows that. So I want to build a device that does that, which means that the only way that this device produces output k prime with certainty is if the input state is k prime. Okay, so that's the key point. The only way this device produces output k prime with certainty the second device is if the input state row A prime is equal to K prime K prime. Otherwise, it will produce other outcomes with some probability. So we deduce from the repeatability of the measurement, which is a type of measurement, that the output state must be an eigenstate associated with the eigenvalue we observed. Okay, and then we get the textbook answer. About the state after measurement. Okay, so those are the considerations that are usually glossed over when you see this statement. And so one of the nice things about this approach of indirect measurement is that it guarantees you get this ideal textbook behavior. Any questions about that? Yeah. Have you seen this already? When? Oh, just previous. Okay, good. Is this new to at least some of you? Okay, good. All right. Okay, so now let's return to describing this kind of formalism. So now the formalism is that essentially our measurement consisted of row A tensor row B, some unitary operation followed by identity tensor, let me call it pi k if you don't mind. So here pi k is just kk. And this unitary was constrained by that rule that it has to take eigenstates of A to eigenstates of B. I wrote that. So the unitary was determined by that rule up there. Okay, here's a good question for you guys. So is the unitary fully determined by that condition? And forget about the global phase. Obviously, that's going to change. No? Let's think about it. So a unitary is a linear operator. And a linear operator is determined if its action on every element of a basis is determined. So how many, so we know the basis is a dimension, let's call D the dimension of both systems, so it's dimension D squared. So have we specified its action on D squared elements? We've only specified its action on D elements because we fixed the second state to be zero. So the unitary is underdetermined. We actually only care about how it acts when the device is in its ready state, zero. If it's not in its ready state, then anything can happen, and that's not part of our concern. So the point is, we can represent this effectively, and then we get the probability of some outcome L, where we think of L as the system AL, is equal to the trace of this big expression. But now from what we've seen, we remark, this is a projector. We can identify, what did I call it, P anywhere? Well, let's call it P now. We can identify P nu as, what would it be, U dagger identity tensor pi k U. So then we have the probability of L is equal to the trace of P nu rho A tensor rho B P nu. Strictly speaking, this is P nu dagger, but P nu is self-adjoint. I've inserted U dagger U is equal to identity a couple places. So now this is exactly, well, now I use the cyclic property of the trace. And this is equal to the trace of P nu rho A tensor rho B, which is exactly what we considered up here, except we had identity as, no, we didn't have identity as input, good. So now the point is, that means we can represent this as the trace of E nu rho A, where E nu is going to be defined the same way it was defined here. Yeah, there. Yes. Oh, just for lack of symbols. I should call it L, in fact. In fact, okay, you're right. So this should be an L. Actually, what it should be is K prime. K prime, 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 K prime. Thank you. Where then the outcome K prime of system 2 is correlated with the input, with the eigenvalues of this operator AL, which is what we're originally measuring. This is operator A with eigenstates AL, or eigenvalues AL. Okay, so we've seen now that von Neumann's indirect measurement can be modeled in terms of this POVM formalism. Okay, so here what we've done is we've modeled the Born rule statistics via the POVM for von Neumann's indirect measurement model. But now there's some subtlety about, if I just tell you that this is my model of measurement, and I don't tell you that this is what I actually did to get that model of measurement, the problem is that there's a non-unique relationship. So there's more than one operational scheme that leads to the same effective POVM. So what that means in particular is if I just tell you that this is the POVM I measured and I got outcome K prime, what's the stay after the measurement? You don't know. It's underdetermined. You have to know how they did that measurement in order to know what the output state is. Yes? Yeah, it is. Yeah, so we're unitarily rotating a unitary rotations preserve eigenvalues. So the eigenvalues will be 0 and 1. Okay, yes? What I said is that the outcome and the probability of the outcome is fully determined by the POVM, but the state you're using to describe the system after the measurement is not fully determined by the POVM. It's underdetermined. So in other words, what I can do is I can measure this I can get this Born rule statistics for this POVM. Right, so the Born rule statistics are the probability of nu trace E nu rho A for this set of operators E nu. This is the Born rule statistics for each nu. Okay, so there's a probability associated with each nu. That's what I mean. I can get the same a POVM which produces that exact set of statistics for any input state correctly can be implemented in more than one way. So it's the quantum state after the measurement that's underdetermined. The statistics are determined. But the state update rule, what's the state that comes out of the box? Is it going to be repeatable or not? Well, it's only going to be repeatable if you said, hey, I measured this POVM, and I did it via von Neumann's indirect measurement method, and hence this is a repeatable measurement. Then I'm going to know what the output state is. But if you did it a different way, then I won't know what the output state is. That's what I meant to say. Yes.
So in this case, like when you do this measurement, you don't need to use the whole pieces of U, right? Like just you only need to know how you transform in terms of L and zero.
Right.
Like, is there any way that you can get around this, like without constructing the full U such that you can still do this measurement? Like in this case, you still need to know the full U, right?
You don't need to know the full U.
Oh, but like otherwise you don't have the integrate.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, okay, there's kind of different levels here. So there's, you know, how does this work?
Okay, so as a theorist, you write down some matrix and you say, you go to your friend in their lab and say, implement this matrix as a transformation. And then they say, well, I can only implement transformations that are unitary. Is it a unitary matrix? And you say, yes, it's unitary. They say, sure, I can do it. And now you can give them another U, which is the same in terms of its action on these input states, but it's different in terms of its action if the input state for B isn't zero. And they can also implement that. And they can get the right answer. It'll work. So if you just say, well, look, here is a subset of coefficients of U that satisfies this constraint, but I'm leaving all the other components of U unspecified, then the experiment will say, okay, look, I can implement this, but I have to make some choice about what those other coefficients are, because the only thing I can physically do in the lab is a unitary. And so then it's in that sense. So it's underdetermined in the sense that there are several different unitaries which will give us exactly this functionality, but an experimentalist has to pick one. They can't kind of partially implement it. That violates our postulates, right? Because our postulate was every transformation is described by a unitary operator. So this isn't weak measurement, this is indirect measurement. So maybe just highlight the difference, because I know you have a homework assignment. So a weak measurement is essentially this model, except, remember when I correlated the index L for B over there? we implicitly assume that these are an orthonormal, or explicitly assume that these are an orthonormal basis, so they don't overlap. Now, if you design your unitary so that the states of B actually, for distinct input states L, the states of B have some overlap, then that's a weak measurement, and it has different properties. Yeah.
So it's indirect.
Right.
You said that when you measure type B, spinocyte A can look out.
Right.
But
well, because of signaling, I should say. Signal, which is stronger than locality.
So the thing is that the state you have at site A is actually a reduced density matrix.
Yes. Well, be careful. It's a reduced density matrix. Where's my figure?
Up the unitary.
It's a reduced density matrix at that initial time point after the interaction.
Yes.
After the measurement, it's a conditional matrix. It's not a, it's not. Yes. Once you're very precise. It's once the information arrives, exactly. So for example, if Alice is at the top there measuring the upper line and Bob is at the bottom dealing with the lower line, and they're space-like separated, Alice can predict Bob's outcome better than he can because now she knows what outcome he's going to get. But Bob doesn't know what outcome he's going to get until Alice sends him the information about what outcome she got. So it's a nice, it's an important consideration since this issue of locality becomes very murky later on. Okay, some very good questions. Okay, this is some heavy-handed math next. Which is just for those of you who like this kind of thing. One can model continuous outcomes. So here we've been treating the outcome k as some discrete index. It's labeling an orthonormal basis. We can also have continuous outcomes. And we can write down a POVM for continuous outcomes. And there's a little bit of technical background for that, but let me just outline it for you. We can define a POVM measurement for continuous outcomes. Okay, you know we need this in the case of measurement of position and momentum. So what we have is we have some set omega. We want to talk about probabilities, so we have to define a sigma algebra on the set omega. And we'll call this sigma algebra scripted F. Okay, so there's like three precise conditions that define what a sigma algebra is. In practice, you only really need to work with the simplest case, which is think about the set omega being the real line or the interval 0 to 2 pi, which are, say, the different, a pointer can point anywhere in 2 pi. In practice, you never get an exact number readout. You don't find out that the answer is, you know, the angle of the needle was 0.25 with infinite decimals precision. You only measure it to within some finite resolution, which is an interval of the real line. That's called the Borel sigma algebra, which is the most important example that we're familiar with. And the Borel sigma algebra is just basically the set of open or closed intervals on your continuous set. So it encodes this idea that we want to assign probabilities to plausible events, and those are events that have some finite resolution, because we never can check something to infinite precision. Okay, so that's the only reason for this, introducing this structure. So now we have elements x of this sigma algebra. Okay, so here you should think of some element x as a subinterval, for example, the interval AB, which is a subset of the real line. And so it encodes this idea that here's my pointer, and I have some continuous set of values, and this is point A, and this is point B, and I have some delta, which is equal to A minus B, so it's the size of this region, and that this is my resolution. The resolution with which I can read the pointer. There's nothing to do with quantum mechanics. This is just like, look, I have this macroscopic pointer. I can only distinguish to within some delta where it's pointing. So I'm going to associate the event X with the needle being in this interval. Okay, and then we say a POVM is some object E that takes elements of the sigma algebra to linear operators. So we're assigning a linear operator to each interval. So in other words, I'm saying I want to know the probability that I get between A and B or between C and D. And so I'll associate some positive operator E with this interval and some other positive operator E with this interval. So the right-hand side here is the operator assigned to that interval. And then we have three conditions. We need that the operator assigned to any allowed element of the sigma algebra, which is essentially a measurable set, must be non-negative for every x that some allowed interval I can measure. I need to require that if I'm checking if I get any outcome at all, so is the needle pointing somewhere in the set? Well, that should correspond to the identity operation. I've essentially learned nothing. And then the third condition is kind of a technical condition, which is that if we assign an operator to disjoint intervals, so is the needle either in AB or in CD, but not anywhere else? So that's a union of these two intervals. So I want the positive operator associated to the union of two disjoint intervals to be just the sum of the positive operators associated with each interval. Okay, so that's a very natural condition to expect. The probabilities add, for disjoint events, probabilities add in the right way. So these are not probabilities yet, they're the positive operators, but then we have the kind of generalized Born rule, which allows us to predict experimental statistics using our mathematics, and the generalized Born rule is going to be that the probability of the event X is equal to the trace of EX rho. Okay, so that's how we describe continuous outcomes. Rho is the input state. Okay, so it's what goes into the box. So this is an element of the sigma algebra. This is an operator. So now we see the full reason for the heavy-handed terminology, positive operator valued measure. Here we have a positive operator valued measure. So this is a condition that you expect measures to satisfy, which are defined on sigma algebras. And now we have an operator valued measure, which encodes that condition we need for probability theory to work nicely. Okay, but in practice, you typically, it's enough to understand the discrete setting, and dealing with a continuous case just involves some extra technical. I think conceptually, it's better to think about the discrete case, which again, you recover the discrete case just by assigning a discrete outcome to each disjoint interval of interest. So I can divide up my region into 10 disjoint intervals, and I have outcomes 1 through 10, which label these disjoint intervals, and I don't have to worry about all this heavy-handed it's not that heavy-handed, but most of you probably aren't familiar with sigma algebras, so. Okay, good. I guess that's a natural stopping point. Any questions? Yes?
Are the intervals supposed to be non-overlapping, or can they also be overlapping?
They can be overlapping, but it gets messier, because then you're going to violate this condition.
You subtract out, evaluate on the intersection.
Yeah.
How do you fix that?
It would be it's not a quantum mechanical problem. It's a problem of how do you deal with this at the probability theory level, and then you just mimic that in the, at this level. Anything else?
I just wanted to ask, how do you define the positive operator?
Oh, yeah, this came up after class last class, so let me just make sure you guys all know what it means. So there was some question about whether you were guaranteed that it was Hermitian. So a positive operator, so first of all, when we say positive operator, we don't actually mean positive operator. We mean non-negative operator.
I'm going to say we, I mean whoever coined the term. So when they say a positive operator valued measure, they really mean a non-negative operator valued measure. Okay, and a non-negative operator is any operator that satisfies, let's call it E. It means that for every state in my Hilbert space, the operator, when the expectation value is evaluated, it's non-negative. So we allow zero. So this is true for every psi in the Hilbert space. Now, if you go to infinite dimensions, there's going to be some questions of domain here, which we'll ignore for now, or maybe forever. And I'm not coming back to it. But in finite dimensions, it's clear enough. This is the definition. So this guarantees that the eigenvalues are real and positive. OK, good. Thanks for your questions. See you tomorrow.